We don't have a quorum yet, so we can't officially call the meeting to order, but we will like to begin the presentation in the interest of time. And so we'll get to the minutes at the appropriate time as well. But we're wanted to also respect your time today, so we appreciate you being here. We're going to hear a presentation today from the University of Minnesota Academic Health Center. And I'm not sure who starts, but please identify yourself for the record and then begin. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Representative Norris. Good afternoon to everyone. My name is Aaron Friedman. I'm the Vice President for Health Sciences and the Dean of the Medical School. I'm new to this committee, but not new to the university. I arrived in Minnesota about 3 years ago to become the chair of the Department of Pediatrics and stepped into this role in January like many of you stepped into your roles in January. I'll be introducing the people sitting next to me at the table in a few minutes. But first, I'd like to introduce my fellow health sciences deans from the university, and I'll ask them to just wave or let you know who they are as I introduce them. Patrick Lloyd is the dean of dentistry. Educates nearly 80% of all the dentists practicing in Minnesota. Mark Paller is the vice dean of the medical school, where we have been leading the nation in a number of family practice physicians trained each year. Connie Delaney is the dean of the School of Nursing, where a majority of all the advanced practice nurses are educated in our state. Marilyn Speedy is the dean of the College of Pharmacy, the only college of pharmacy dedicated to ensuring towns from Fergus Falls to Hutchinson that they're served by pharmacists. John Finnegan is dean of public health, among the top 10 in the nation, and offers nearly 250 advanced degrees to nearly 40,000 registrants yearly. And Trevor Ames is the dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine, a leader ensuring food is safe and benefiting both consumers and the food industry in our state. They're here to answer questions.
If I can interrupt for just a moment. We now have an official quorum, so I'd like to officially call to order the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee. Have a question, Representative? Oh, okay.
You're going to move the minutes when it comes up.
Well, let's do that right now then. So, Representative Benson moves minutes for February 24th. Any comments, corrections? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the minutes are officially approved. Now, the business is out of the way, so we can continue with your presentation. Thank you.
So we're here to answer questions you may have as I provide an overview of our comprehensive health sciences enterprise at the university, its value and impact to your communities, and the risks associated with plans to cut 15 to 20% from the university's budget. So what's an academic health center? We are the schools that educate the next generation of health professionals who serve families and communities in Minnesota. The dentists, the physicians, the advanced practice nurses, the pharmacists, the public health professionals, and the veterinarians. Our faculty practice in competitive marketplaces to fulfill our mission. We perform health research that's both privately and publicly funded to improve health, and we have community partnerships throughout our state. There are six schools in the Academic Health Center offering 62 degree programs delivered at 1,500 sites throughout the state to 6,400 students and taught by 1,400 faculty. For many of the professions that we teach, we are the only educator in the state or the region. Overall, we train 70% of the state's health professionals, with the only veterinary medicine school in the state, the only college of pharmacy in the state, the primary school for advanced practice nurses in the state, the only public health school in the state, and a medical school that educates more than 80% of the state's medical students and more than half of the state's medical residents. And we are the only dental school between Milwaukee and Seattle. In addition, the faculty in our schools who teach students also conduct over 425 million, in privately and publicly funded research with the goal of improving the health and discovering treatments and cures. And many of our faculty also take care of patients. So why care for the patients? There are actually two important reasons. It's an important way to teach students by working alongside them, and it's patient care that supports the mission of our schools. In the Academic Health Center, approximately 15% of our revenue comes from state support. In the past year alone, we had an $18 million cut in the state support. We cut administrative overhead and efficiently combined roles, such as the one I'm in right now, which is both Vice President for the Academic Health Center and Dean of the Medical School. We've consolidated administrative functions across our schools, such as information technology, human resources, and finance. But state funding is still crucial to maintaining our mission as a valuable resource to Minnesota. Each dollar of state support into the health sciences leverages close to $9 in revenue from both public and private research grants and from taking care of patients. These patients range from people seeking dental care in our Minneapolis, Hibbing, or Willmar clinics, to patients going to primary care clinics in Eagan, to pioneering and life-saving cancer treatments at the University of Minnesota Medical Center. In total, there are more than 460,000 patients who visit our clinics every year. And we can't forget our four-legged friends seeking treatment in the veterinary medical center. You've probably read about some of the research conducted at our university. Our faculty competes for and has received nearly $426 million in the past year in research dollars. That's half of all the research funding coming to the University of Minnesota. We're focused on addressing complex conditions or diseases that affect the majority of the citizens in our state, the kind of conditions we see in clinics as our population ages and as we become more sedentary. For example, diabetes is strongly related to the obesity epidemic, and obesity is also related to an increase in cancer cases. These are expensive conditions for families to manage. In our School of Public Health, we've learned how to encourage more activity amongst our school children and to reduce the impact and the cost of the care we have to deliver. In the medical school, we're looking at better treatment strategies, and we're working on cures as well. In the School of Nursing, we're working on additional wellness strategies, and in pharmacy, our faculty are seeking better ways to deliver drugs to treat patients. Sitting next to me is a national leader in heart disease, Dr. Dan Gary, director of the Lilly High Heart Institute and head of our cardiovascular division in the medical school. I'll turn it over to Dan.
Thank you, Dr. Friedman. Chair Norris, members of the committee, as Dr. Friedman said, I'm a native Minnesotan. I grew up in Fairmont, Minnesota, attended college at St. John's University, and then received my medical degree from the University of Minnesota. Afterwards, I went south to finish and complete my fellowship training at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. Today, I lead one of the world's most innovative and famous heart programs through the Lilly High Heart Institute at the University of Minnesota, where open heart surgery was pioneered some 60 years ago. First successful open heart surgery was performed just 7.5 miles from here in 1952. Now, at that time, this was an era of considerable controversy, as many thought that such a procedure was not possible. And some even thought that the heart was a receptacle of one's soul at that time. And so it was felt that open heart surgery was not feasible. Well, today, open heart surgery is not only common, but it's almost routine. Today, heart disease is the number one cause of death worldwide. It's also the number one cause of death in our country. In addition, in our Minnesota hospitals, we undertake now this procedure, open heart surgery, more than 10,000 times a year. 50,000 patients in our Minnesota hospitals receive therapy using catheter-based therapy. These therapies have impacted all of us. We're all touched by heart disease, through our family members, through our neighbors, through our members of our community. And these therapies that are undertaken in these Minnesota hospitals are aimed at bypassing blockages in our heart vessels. They're aimed at repairing valves, and they're aimed at implanting devices. Devices like this, the pacemaker. It's this device, it's this pacemaker, that was the result of an innovative partnership between a University of Minnesota physician, C. Walton Lillehei, and an engineer, Earl Bakken. Ultimately, this technology, this pacemaker, launched a $16 billion Fridley-based company, Medtronic. And so it's this innovation, the spirit of innovation, that we at the University of Minnesota aim not only to treat heart disease, but to cure heart disease. We want to cure it, and we want to prevent it. One strategy that we're taking in my laboratory is aimed at discoveries to regenerate tissue, regenerate the heart, to impact children that are born with heart defects, the most common defect that children are born with, and to regenerate tissue that is injured following a heart attack. So just like in 1952, when the University of Minnesota rocked the world and made a profound impact in the treatment of heart disease, we too want to impact the treatment of our family members, of our neighbors in our communities here in Minnesota. So thank you very much for all the support that you give the University of Minnesota.
If I can just interrupt for just a moment and comment that a classmate of mine from high school died of heart disease a couple of years ago. And I know he donated his body to the university. Now, is that a common thing? I mean, I assume that's part of your research. That was his intention, anyway, to make sure that somebody learned from his unfortunate situation.
Chair Nornes, I think that, to be brief, I think that's one of the greatest things that any individual can do after they die is to help us either in providing organs, and there's a tremendous shortage of organs for transplantation. And so that's why we're pursuing new therapies aimed at cell therapy. But also in medical school training, it's absolutely essential that we learn about our bodies and we teach the next generation. And this is a very successful program at the University of Minnesota with regards to teaching, with regards to organ transplantation, and with regards to cell therapy.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, Representative Detmer has a question also.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. More so a comment. Dr. Gary, thank you. My little brother had a heart transplant, and you mentioned that at one time people thought the heart dealt with the soul. Well, I know people, after they go through a heart transplant, they have a pretty good idea where their soul is going to go after that, the miracle of a heart transplant. Thank you.
If I can just provide a comment, Chair Nornes, Representative Detmer. It's important to know that the University of Minnesota is among the world leaders in heart transplantation. We have now transplanted more than 730 hearts. We're the oldest program in the state of Minnesota, and we have the best survival with regards to heart transplantation. So this is wonderful technologies that really provide patients with a second chance.
Representative Marlowe, do you have a question, or did you? You did not. Okay. Representative Benson, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's just no doubt we're all in awe of the things that you've accomplished and that you do. And this is kind of a break in the action so that I can ask the question from a more practical standpoint, at least for me, in trying to understand. Because you even opened up with a comment regarding, not you personally, but the speaker did, regarding looking at 15-20% reduction. That is huge. And my hope is that we don't have to get there. But nevertheless, from a practical standpoint, I know that I commented to my brother here over next to me, Mr. Banyan. We both are, he's more so than I am, but he teaches at a state university. And can you comment a little bit in terms of the faculty to student ratio? You know, simple math, it's less than 5-1. And I'd love to know that that was going to be my ratio. But I also know that there's a lot of differences, you know, in terms of practicality with that. But at least for me, from a budget standpoint, it would help me to know if you could explain that.
Sure, I'll be happy Friedman? To address that if I can, Chairman Ornus. We have a responsibility because we're training professionals. We have a responsibility to the state and to the citizens of the state to be able to say to you, we've seen this person do that job, and we think they can do it, and therefore they should move on. When we give the MD degree, for example, I think it's everybody's expectation that we know this person can do the job as a doctor. That's not possible without somebody really laying eyes on what that individual does. And so that kind of faculty to student ratio or student to faculty ratio, whichever way you want to put it, involves having that kind of knowledge and visibility. And that's, I think, what all of our professional schools really, that's what the expectation is of all of our professional schools. So it is a somewhat different student to faculty ratio than you might have in, say, an undergraduate education. But I think it's crucial to being able to give that degree and assure the public that these people can do the job.
Representative Benson?
As a follow-up, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to belabor it, but I mean, from a standpoint of the budget process and the like, do you compare yourselves to other top-notch schools regarding this ratio and whether or not that kind of falls in line?
It absolutely falls.
Mr. Friedman?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Morrow?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to wait, but I'll follow up on Representative Benson's questions then. You've talked about the amount of research and amount of research funding you bring in and how important the advances that you've brought affect the lives around the table. And maybe you're getting to it, but I'll ask the question. What happens if there's a 15% and what happens if there's a 20% cut in your budget?
So, Representative
Friedman,
if you'll allow us, we'll get to that. So. If we haven't answered your question, can we get to it afterwards? Thank you.
Okay, we have a question from Representative Norton as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question actually was, I think the follow-up that Representative Benson asked, which is, are we similar to or dissimilar to other colleges and universities that provide the level? And I think you answered that we're very similar to. So that was what I was getting at.
Thank you. Representative Depke?
Yes, and I'm sorry I don't want to belabor this point, but I am curious. Has that student to professor changed over the years dramatically? Like, let's say, for instance, in 1952, what was the student to ratio then? And then, and if it changed, what brought you to change that? That ratio.
Representative Norton,
Friedman.
I'm not sure I can answer what it was in 1952, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think the ratio probably has changed somewhat as our schools, some of which have their missions have changed somewhat also. So I think we'd actually have to look that up to be able to be sure how to answer your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, you can continue.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Norton. One other thing I do want to get to is what we have done in recent years involves expanding the number of our graduates who go into psychiatry. I think you've probably heard, and it's been a long-standing issue, and that is the ability to provide mental health services to our state is something that is sorely needed. So on my other side is Dr. Patty Dickman, a first-year resident in psychiatry, and I'll turn it over to Pat.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome. Again, please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Patty Dickman. I'm a resident physician at the University of Minnesota. So, Chair Nornes, members of the committee, I grew up in St. Paul, and I attended the University of Minnesota for my undergraduate education. And I had such a fantastic experience as an undergraduate at the university that I chose to pursue my medical education at the University of Minnesota as well. And in recent years, there have been several changes to the curriculum that have benefited students, including ratios as low as 1-5 with a physician teaching us, one physician to five students, to as big as one to about 165 lecture-style formats. So it really is an integrative approach where you can benefit from small groups and large group discussions. So it's kind of fits all different learning styles in that regard. Upon graduation from medical school at the University of Minnesota, I had the opportunity to pursue residency at, you know, I could choose where I wanted to go, and I applied at Ivy League schools, interviewed there, but again, I chose the University of Minnesota for my residency program as well. And part of that was due to the high quality of the resident physicians at the program, the outstanding faculty members that, again, are physicians and teachers and researchers. A lot of our staff have filled three different roles. We have cutting-edge research in the area of psychiatry, specifically first episode schizophrenia. Typically, schizophrenia first hits at around somewhere between age 18 and 29. And if it's caught early on, about 75% of these young people can go on to lead successful, productive lives in society. They can get a job, housing, whereas if it's not quite early, this disease can be devastating. It really is a chronic illness. But we are doing research into discovering different biomarkers that not only detect the disease, but also aid in the treatment of psychosis and schizophrenia. And that's just one area of research in the Department of Psychiatry going on currently. We have world experts in depression, eating disorders, borderline personality, so really a wide range at the University of Minnesota. Upon graduation, graduation from residency in about 4 years, I hope to go into child and adolescent psychiatry and continue working in the Twin Cities area. I love it here. It's a great place to live and work. So I hope to continue to serve the needs of my
community. Somebody has a cell phone that's interfering with us right now. Really interfering with us now. So if they have a BlackBerry or something, you can shut it off. It would be helpful. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, that's all right.
Yeah.
I'm finished. Okay.
I didn't realize that. I know you've got a little show and tell there, but
I do have a bit of a show and tell here. This is a human brain. In psychiatry, we study neurotransmitters that circulate throughout the brain. This area in the front, this is known as the prefrontal cortex. This is an area affecting a lot of judgment, behavior, again, and this is an area of significant dysregulation in mental illness. So the therapies that we're working on developing, some target specific areas of the brain, others target neurotransmitters that really do circulate throughout the brain. So thank you.
When you hold that up, mm-hmm. and when you think about the congresswoman that was shot, mm-hmm. and the miracle of piercing that and still look at recovery,
right?
That's pretty amazing.
It really is remarkable, and that's one of the amazing parts of the brain is that it is able to recover after an injury such as that. After things like strokes, the brain is able to restructure kind of the hardwiring in the neurons in the brain to accommodate in that area of neuronal loss. So it really is a remarkable organ, and we are just at the brink of making all sorts of new discoveries, and it's a really exciting and growing field right now.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. If you want a closer look after the meeting, you all can go up.
Welcome to come up.
Yeah. Any questions from members? I guess I was a little surprised that it's that long a process for you. You could almost be a heart surgeon.
Chair Norris, thank you. I chose psychiatry because I love it, but you're right, it is a long path. 4 years of undergraduate, 4 years of medical school, and 4 years of residency plus a fellowship.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. Congratulations for being willing to work
and
accomplish that. Representative Depke is ahead of you.
Thank you very much. Could you tell me, you're very eloquent, by the way, of why you selected the University of Minnesota for an advanced medical degree. Do we know what percent of our advanced medical students come from Minnesota colleges and that are in the advanced degree program? What percent of? I know we educate 70% of the doctors, that you mentioned that. What percent of those doctors have had their undergraduate degree from Minnesota colleges? Do we know that?
Mr. Friedman?
Thank you again, Chair Nornes. Are you asking, we have to be clear on what your question is.
Yes.
We have, if you're asking whether Minnesota colleges in general, as any college in Minnesota, mm-hmm. and whether they've completed their degrees and completed their residencies or mm-hmm. just completed their medical degrees?
I guess I was thinking primarily their medical degrees, and it might be easier for you, and I could rephrase the question, if what percent of our advanced students that go on to get their advanced medical degrees before residency come from the University of Minnesota?
Okay. So if I could take that, Chair Lawrence. A bit, around 80% of the admitting class to medical school comes from Minnesota.
Thank you very much.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, when the university comes here and makes their presentations and tries to tell us the effect of, general fund cuts to their budget and its effect on tuition, they talk about the undergraduate Minnesota resident. Dr. Dickman, you went through school and then graduate school. Can you tell us what kind of debt you graduated with?
I would be happy to, Chair Norris.
Maybe not happy, but they happy
more
to
than
tell them.
Ms. Dickman?
The average debt of one of my medical school classmates was $200,000 last year. And our medical school is one of the top three, I believe, most expensive public medical schools in the country right now. And that, coupled with debt from undergraduate education, which could easily be $30,000 or more for typical public undergraduate education, but many of my colleagues came from MIT, Yale, Harvard, so they had as much as, $150,000 coming right out of undergrad. So it really does add up quickly.
And Representative Rukavina?
Mr. Chair, for the other two gentlemen, are we doing anything to, it's hard to entice someone to go, depending on what kind of practice they're in as a doctor, to go to rural Minnesota when they can probably have a better practice and pay off that debt in the metropolitan area. So refresh our memory. Are we offering any? I mean, we're offering residencies in St. Cloud and Mayo. Do we in Duluth? Do we require a location in a rural area? I can't remember, for some type of scholarships or tuition buy down or whatever.
Dr. Friedman,
thank you, Chair Nornes. Actually, I'm going to get to some of that. So, if it's okay, can I hold that question and whatever we didn't?
But I got a really pressing question for you, Dr.
Okay.
Friedman, and that is, thank you, Mr. Chair. Be honest with us. DFL heart is bigger than a Republican heart, isn't it?
I'm going to let
be honest now.
Representative Benson?
No response?
That requires a retort, but isn't it true that the Republican brain is bigger?
Representative Bannion, do you have a question?
I hate to break up the frivolity. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned, Dr. Dickman, the fact that $200,000 is the average. I mean, there's obviously a return on that investment. Otherwise, you don't decide to go into this practice at all. How long does it take your average doctor? Let's just deal with your own classmates. How long do you think it's going to take to pay that back?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are all sorts of loan programs available. Typically, it takes between 10 and 25 years, sometimes longer. Luckily, there are some rural areas that offer loan reimbursement options. It's more common to have those in rural areas or underserved areas as compared to the Twin Cities. So that is a nice benefit that can help pay back loans a bit sooner.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bennion.
Thank you. I guess the point is to compare that to what happens in other fields. I know from personal experience getting a, and I'm looking over at Representative Morrow having this conversation, that we probably both took on a good bit of student debt when we went to our fields. It probably took us many years to pay back that debt as well. I don't know about you. Maybe you got more scholarships than I did, because maybe we're the exemption, you know, the exceptions to Representative Benson's rule. But it does seem to me that you know, 10 years wouldn't be unusual for a payback time on most any student debt. But if it was 25 years, I mean, that's a pretty wide range. And I'm trying to put 200,000 is a number that would just, you know, cause everyone to gasp. I was trying to put that in a context. Thank you.
I believe we can continue. Dr. Friedman?
Thank you, Chairman. Mm-hmm. I think Dr. Dickman provides an example of the work we do at the university to ensure that health professionals that we're graduating are serving our communities and families. But I'm also certain it's not news to you that there are critical shortages in this state in primary care physicians. Let me give you a example of that. This is a map of the state, and it demonstrates in many areas in our state. As you can see, there the legend will show where the primary care shortage areas are, and it's throughout our state. We have a responsibility, and we feel strongly that we should be helping in this regard. And what you'll see is that these shortages, unfortunately, are not just in primary care. This map refers to primary care, but there are also shortages in psychiatry. You may be surprised to learn that there are shortages in surgery, in orthopedics, in nursing, in dentistry, in pharmacy, in large animal veterinary medicine. And the shortage is acute in greater Minnesota. We, as I mentioned, are doing our part to make a difference, but that's a crucial area of concern for all of us.
Dr. Friedman?
Yes.
Just an observation, I guess. I'm from Otter Tail County, and for whatever reason, our county has all three designations. It's divided, dissected right. At least three different ways, which I find interesting. Some areas underserved and not designated and so forth. So
if I may answer that, Chairman,
yes.
Part of the reason for that is that this is done in a radius. In other words, where the physicians may be or where the nursing may be and so forth, you then take a radius and say, that covers that particular area, but if you're outside of that and don't have that sort of representation, you're now in a shortage area, so it shouldn't be a surprise, depending on the size of the county and so forth,
sure.
That we'll see that sort of change.
Thanks.
So this chart, as I mentioned, demonstrates the number of professionals. Nope, I'll come back to that in a second. I do want to touch on one other important area, and that's what this next slide actually does. This is another challenge that's an issue for our state and one that we do feel we have to help address. The shortage in the physician population is expected to grow with the aging of the Minnesota population and with a large number of our health professionals likely to retire in the next 5 to 10 years. I'm going to go off script for a second and just point out I am a pediatric specialist. And my own practice was taking care of children with kidney disease. The state of Minnesota doesn't need a lot of people who do that. But I just want to point out that if we take all of us in pediatrics who are specialists, the median age of those specialists is 57. So that as we spend our time and think about how we're going to take care of our children, whether they're in primary care or requiring specialty care, we have an aging physician population as well as an aging general population. And one of the issues that this state has, and many states in the Upper Midwest have, is it's not that easy to recruit our physician group from other states. We have a responsibility and a need to, in effect, grow our own. We know that if
Representative Rukavina?
Chair, Doctor, to that point, so, or to whomever up there, what percentage of your student population then, whether regardless of what medical field they're going into, is Minnesota residents?
So again, thank you, Chair Nornis. When we look at who starts in our medical school, 80% of them come from Minnesota. They start there. They are citizens of the state of Minnesota. Another 20% are not.
Is that overall the same in the School of Veterinary Medicine or Dentistry?
So in the School of Dentistry, approximately, I believe it's 55%. Is that correct, Patrick?
Because, Mr. Chair and members, for the freshmen, you know, we had that issue of dental, advanced dental practice at the Minsky system, and you know, the dentists fought it, and the University of Minnesota, I believe, fought it. Correct me if I'm wrong.
If I could continue, I just want to point something out. Of the other 45% who come from other states, they're mainly from other parts of the Upper Midwest, which is North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and actually we have a small number of students who come from Manitoba. Now, what I want to point out is of that 45% who start in our dental school, half of those stay in Minnesota. So, in fact, if we look at our numbers, nearly 65 to 70% of the students who start at our dental school are practicing in Minnesota.
Well, I only have anecdotal evidence, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if it's like this in other rural parts of the state of Minnesota, but almost all of our dentists are originally from the Iron Range, and I think the youngest one might be Dr. Zupancic, who's probably 48 years old, and we've managed to get some young dentists to come back, but it was through a local scholarship buy-down type program where we required them. It is very difficult, and my understanding has been that the dentistry school is somewhat, you know, out of kilter, I guess, if we want to call it that, as far as its Minnesota admissions and that as compared to the other. But I could be wrong, but all I can tell you is anecdotally, pretty soon, you know, we're going to be just pulling our teeth out and, you know, maybe using old birch bark false teeth like George Washington, because we have no one coming out, and I don't know if it's the same in Otter Tail and other Bemidji or whatever, but it is happening up in our area.
Dr. Friedman?
Chair Norris, I do think it is fair to point out, though, again, that over 70% of the graduates of the dental school are practicing, stay in Minnesota, practicing.
Yeah.
Hmm. Let me, if I could continue, Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
Many of the people who we've trained do practice in greater Minnesota, and one of the successful programs that we have addresses one of the previous questions, and that's the what we term the Rural Physicians Associates Program. It has a 40-year track record of educating and ultimately placing physicians in communities like Fergus Falls, St. Cloud, and Bemidji. We also have teaching dental clinics in Hibbing and Wilmer, and we know that the communities without sufficient or adequate health care will not grow jobs, will not attract and create growth in our economy. And we do feel that and recognize that. The flexible programs we've developed with our communities receive critical funding through the medical education and research cost programs that have been part of our state's programming for a number of years. In the governor's budget, these dollars have been cut in half. And this can have and will have an important effect on how we train and where we train students and residents. We also know that where we train residents has an impact on where they practice. This is not just a Minnesota finding, it's a national finding. People stay where they're trained. Most of our professionals require hands-on training and experience in working clinics as part of their curriculum. Without it, students don't graduate, they don't pass national exams, or get licensed. It's a requirement. We have to be able to do that, not only in the medical school, but in all of our academic health center professional schools. So we here in Minnesota, and this is a shared we, the university, state government, the citizens of the state, face a number of critical issues in the health sciences and in health care. We do have a shortage, and a growing shortage, of physicians, nurses, pharmacists, dentists, public health professionals, and especially large animal veterinarians in Minnesota. We do have to sustain and perhaps even grow our enrollments, maintain and strengthen our training programs across the state, and work with communities to encourage our graduates to stay in Minnesota and practice in our communities across the state. Each of our schools is highly competitive. We do attract the best and the brightest because we know that's what our families and our state expect, and we have nearly 4,700 applicants for about 230 medical positions, medical slots for first-year medical students every year. And it's similarly competitive in nursing, in dentistry, in pharmacy, and in veterinary medicine. At the same time, our tuitions are high, and we have to be market sensitive to the fees that we charge compared to other programs in the rest of the country. Again, we're seeking the best students who are committed to be professionals in our state, but we need core state support to ensure that we can retain our class sizes and our enrollments here in Minnesota. We need to sustain our clinical enterprises to ensure the best and most advanced care is available to the families of our state, that we maintain access to places to train our students, and places to translate our research discoveries into care and into cures. We exist in a market environment in the health sciences that presents special challenges that are different than in other parts of the university. We operate clinics. We operate a hospital. We provide care to patients in a heavily regulated environment and with reimbursement rates that are challenged. The way we educate students is in flux. We have more coursework taking place in teams, online, and with simulation. But all that technology only augments the true core of the health professional education, which takes place in the form of an apprenticeship training alongside practicing providers in communities throughout our state. So we rely on community hospitals and clinics as co-educators who work with us to ensure the state remains well served. We also have to maintain our competitive edge in research. One of the other reasons we have a 1-to-5 ratio is that we have some really very important research going on, and those are faculty members who are performing that kind of research activity. And in order to retain and to recruit the nation's best researchers and staff to Minnesota, we have to be able to continue to look for new treatments, new cures, share them with our patients and with the health providers throughout our state. It's our discovery that also sustains the state's health industry, creating new products and services, new jobs, and new companies, just like Dr. Gary demonstrated with Medtronic. We take these challenges seriously. The decisions we make today will affect the health of the people of the state for years to come. We require a continued partnership with the university, with the state, and with its communities to help meet that challenge that's before us. So I hope we can take any questions that you have and address them to whomever, those sitting next to me, or to the other colleagues who join me today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Dittmer?
Yeah, Dittmer. Mr. Chair, and then Dr. Friedman. In terms of programs, the military has, expertises in all these areas, too. Do you have residents or people are taking courses there that are also part of the military, they're going to medical school and so forth, and how does that work into your program?
So I see Patty shaking mm-hmm. your head. Do you want to respond?
Dr. Sure. Dickman?
Mr. Chair, I had somewhere between 5 and 10 colleagues in my graduating medical school class who are members of the Air Force, Navy, National Guard, and for the most part, that military program allows them to complete their medical education. It pays for that education as well as a stipend. They complete a residency, they can do a civilian residency or a Navy residency, whatever, and then they owe that military branch 4+ years of service following graduation. I did have one classmate that was called over to Iraq during medical school, but it's my understanding that she did have some opinion in the matter. That was her choice. She wanted to go to Iraq and serve her country, and she came back. And the nice part about our medical school is we have a flexible MD program, which allows students to take an additional year of medical school without paying extra money to participate in the military, to go travel and Africa, served underserved countries in Africa, Asia, wherever they'd like to go. So to answer your question, yes, we do have many class members in the military, and our medical school is very accommodating to that.
And Mr. Chair, just follow up, do you see that those numbers increasing, taking advantage of that type of program?
Dr. Dickman?
Chair, the flexible MD, is that what you're referring to? The military?
Do you see the number of military people that are in medical school now increasing?
Maybe I can help Representative Nornes. I don't know if it will increase for a very important reason. That is, first of all, let me point out that when people have to do their military requirement, they very often have to leave the state. Mm-hmm. And some of them, we don't get back. So while it is clearly a benefit to the nation for us to do that, it may not necessarily be a benefit to the state. Having said that, there's a limited number of opportunities within the armed forces for this. So, and this type of training is available throughout the country. So I don't think that number is going to change very much over the course of the next few years.
Okay, thank you.
I just had one question. You had mentioned Fairview in your early part of the presentation. What is the exact relationship between the university and Fairview?
Thank you, Dr. Representative Nornes. The Fairview Health System is the owner of the University of Minnesota Medical Center, the main teaching hospital for the University of Minnesota. And so the relationship is actually quite strong between the two of us, because that is where a large part of our faculty, and I should point out, a large part of education goes on inside the University of Minnesota Medical Center. But it is not sufficient. And so our trainees, not only in medicine, but in a number of other schools, are trained with a number of other programs around the Twin Cities and around the state. So that's the primary relationship we've got.
I bring it up only because of a personal relationship. My wife was sent there by ambulance, and they essentially saved her life. But I embarrassed myself because I didn't know exactly where I was going, and I wound up on the wrong side of the river. Mm-hmm. And so I missed her arrival. You know, it's the story of my life. She was on the east side, I was on the west side. We eventually did find her, but again, the treatment she received was just outstanding.
Thank you, Chair. Sure. And I'll pass that on if that's okay.
Yeah, please do that. I think that probably is the extent of our... Oh, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Chair Nornes. I just have a question. Certainly, I commend all of you. I mean, you come before us and with large brains and huge hearts, and we ask questions that... It just amazes me as we sit here, and you are such experts, and I very much appreciate your time. I just had a question, and maybe it's the dentistry person, but certainly you have a huge debt if you're going into psychiatry. You'd have a huge debt if you're going into heart surgery, huge debt that you'd acquire if you're going into dentistry. But I'm wondering, somebody like who's going into dentistry will also then, if you want them to go and start a small business in a small town, will also incur the debt of beginning a business. And I'm just, I just wanted to touch on that a little bit. If there's an estimation of truly what the amount would be for somebody who's going through the dentistry program, maybe you don't have that, maybe it's more of a comment, but certainly people will incur a great debt, but also then be expected to also plunk down a lot of dollars to be able to start a dentistry practice in a small town and be able to grow that. So, again, it's maybe a comment, but if you had any information on that.
I think we'll take it as a comment,
sure.
I guess. I do know that dentistry is also very, very high-tech these days. It's more than just a drill, and that's got to be expensive. So, Representative Rukavina?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Poppe, I'm glad you brought that up because this it shows the difficulty of attracting to rural Minnesota. And I had two dentists who offered their business for free. Their offices with all the equipment in it to get dentists to come to the range, and they couldn't get a dentist. For free, you can have my practice. I'll give you everything, the chairs, the equipment, the x-rays, all of that stuff. And they wouldn't come because they don't think they can generate enough money to pay that debt. And so, Mr. Chair, if I can, if you're cut the 15 or 20%, and we know that the university tries to keep administration, the cost to the Minnesota resident undergraduate, what does it mean to a graduate student at at one of your schools?
Dr. Friedman?
If I could, can I also ask Dean Loy to respond to the dental question specifically? And I think we'll be able to get to your question also about what does that mean in terms of tuition and debt and so forth, because I think that's where your question is going, if I have that correctly. So one of the questions we had, Patrick, was if the debt of a student, and also what that debt looks like after they have to develop a practice. Do you have some information about that?
Please identify yourself for the record.
Patrick Lloyd, Dental School Dean, University of Minnesota. It's a pleasure to be here and see so many familiar faces. Our debt level is about $195,000 per graduate per year. But we've worked very hard the last 5 years to try to find incentives, enticements to get more of our students to places where they're needed. More significantly, we started the first a national program in early admissions for people who intend to practice in rural Minnesota. Our first class came in this past year. We're creating some financial incentives to get them to those communities. And our admissions process now, 2 years in place, we identified some characteristics about students to be in our programs who intend to practice in rural Minnesota. We found that the person most likely to set up a practice in rural Minnesota is a woman from a town of fewer than 5,000. So our admissions program has as a responsibility selecting those who have a greater propensity to go in greater Minnesota, if you like, and we have identified a catalog of people who we intend to encourage to take that direction. The practice startup fees, we're looking at about $150,000 to start a small, single practice setting. Many of our students, the majority of them, are moving into associateships where they'll take over partnership over time. But you add 150 on top of 190, and that isn't costing anything about moving or transporting yourself to these communities. I know we worked with Representative Rukavina's area through IRRB to create some scholarships, and I appreciate that. We were able to entice two women who we mentioned earlier to move to the area. I just came from upstairs where we were encouraging support for the Merck program that allows 100 of our students each year to spend some time in Hemig or Wilmer, one of our inner city clinics. We know that that's affected substantially. The numbers who've joined the public health service, the Indian Health Service, have settled in greater Minnesota or gone into practices where there's dire needs. So we've done a lot, and I do believe we've got good evidence to show that programs like our outreach, which is highly dependent upon the Merck support, have yielded substantially numbers of students that are moving out in greater Minnesota, looking for career opportunities. And we're working real hard to dispel the notion that there may not be some economic advantages to practice in rural Minnesota. We found that the dentists in rural Minnesota are doing better than those in the Twin Cities. Their appointment opportunities, the practice styles, the lifestyles, they can enjoy great, great experiences living all areas around the state.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, just in this, to kind of follow along in this discussion. There are a couple other things that members of the committee may or may not have heard about, but when we change what we will pay for as a state, as well as reimbursement rates, also affects some of the practitioners' ability to make money, particularly in the rural community. But also this year, I believe on the table for our discussion is the area health education centers around the state, and I understand those might be targeted for cuts, and their whole point and purpose is to help identify practitioners in rural Minnesota. And so that's an area I've been concerned about, and having seen that on the table for potential cuts as well. And I think it goes along with this whole discussion we're having. While it may not fall in the higher ed budget, it may actually through the universities. I think it's something we need to keep our eye on.
Can I just introduce one more comment? We're concerned about the Merck cut at the dental school. We're concerned about the cut to the area health education centers. We're concerned about the university cut trickling down to the dental school. I'm concerned about light rail running right in front of my building for 3 years. You know, so I've got more concerns this year than you can imagine. You know, and we think about trying to restore the basic needs to support our highly intensive faculty, facility, technology, clinics. I'm really worried this year that it's going to put some strains on the systems. It's going to cause us to make some judgments that could have some substantial long-term problems for our state.
Representative Dippy.
Thank you very much. I have been asking our research expert here to give me some information. We saw earlier in the session a pie chart that is similar to what you gave us, which broke down your revenue sources. And so I wanted to take a look at and remind myself where the expenditures were. And taking a look at the medical school and the College of Biological Sciences, I see that we expend a large percent, 9% in the medical school and 15% or 12% in the College of Biological Sciences in debt and leases. Could you give us some background as to why those two are larger than the other parts of the university?
Dr. Friedman.
I think the primary reason for that is the research that goes on, and in particular what we call the wet lab research, meaning those laboratories that when you build that building and you handle the air, you provide the plumbing, you have to handle the electricity in a way that's considerably different. We also have to be able to handle contaminated materials. We have to be able to isolate materials and so forth. Those buildings are at a different log compared to other classroom or other administrative buildings at the university. They're the reason that we have a different debt service in schools like medicine and biological sciences.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm going to come back to the question I asked earlier. We heard from President Brunix, we heard from the Chancellor at Minsky about course sections being cut, faculty positions being cut, tuition going up under a 15%, under a 20% scenario. I may have missed it, and I apologize. Could you give us a little bit more specific guidance of what might happen within the medical school and within the dental school under a 15% and under a 20% cut scenario?
So let me, Representative Nornes, let me address a couple of things at the same time. As I mentioned, one of the areas in professional schools like ours is the possibility to raise tuition. Every one of our schools, with one exception, is essentially at the top in the country for public schools. We don't have that kind of flexibility for the most part. This presents a really interesting problem. If we're going to continue to train our students and to work across greater Minnesota, we may not be able to be in certain places. We may not be able to go to certain clinics. We may not be able to hold, not may not, we won't be able to hold those clinics, to move our faculty there, and to be able to have the presence that we have, because that costs money. The rural physicians program, for example, that we have in the medical school is something that we administer, and we make it possible for our medical students to spend time in a variety of different settings. That's not required by our accreditation bodies to do that. It's the right thing for us to do in Minnesota. But that's the kind of thing that we have to look at in order to be able to accommodate 15 or 20% reductions.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, Doctor. I think that helps me understand in part that accreditation requirements would constrain you. I was taking a quick look. You is toward the top, if not at the top, of tuition. I was looking at student-faculty ratios. It seems like you're in line with your similar institutions, and of course we in this committee don't set faculty-student ratios. That's beyond our purview. But it does seem that what would go and what would go at the University of Minnesota generally is service. And you described service to rural Minnesota. So as a rural member, I need to be concerned when I hear about a 15 or 20% cut to the medical school, it sounds like.
I think that's absolutely fair.
Yeah. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been brought to my attention, and I'm not to state this as to minimize this, the whole idea of the debt load. I think it's enormous to think about that. I put three of my own children through school and paid for it myself. I have another one that's halfway through in its bucks. So I'm not minimizing it. But it has been brought to my attention by looking at federal guidelines that, in fact, many or most will be forgiven after 10 years of faithful payment, that especially for public service, that many of these loans will have forgiveness. And I just wondered if you could speak to that, if in your knowledge. I have the text in front of me. I don't want to read the entire thing, but in your experience, are you aware of the fact that after 10 years of payment that these loans can be forgiven?
Dr. Friedman?
First of all, I'm not entirely sure I know what you mean by the service that's required for the forgiveness, but the majority of our students are not receiving that kind of training.
Right.
We have a response, I believe.
Excuse me.
Just identify yourself.
Trisha Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. That information is in a publication from our office. Beginning in October 2007, the federal government offers loan forgiveness for borrowers who pay on their loans for 10 years or more. For those who are working in government for 10 years or in nonprofit organizations other than those that proselytize. And virtually all medical care in Minnesota is provided as nonprofit. So most of these health professionals should be eligible for loan forgiveness for their federal loans after 10 years of working in these jobs.
That should be good news, I guess. Dr. Friedman?
Well, actually, two comments. First of all, many of the loans that our students have are not federal loans. In fact, the vast majority of them are not federal loans. And secondly, if you're working in a nonprofit, that's really great. But if you look at the private practices around our state, and the work that people are doing in those communities and so forth, they're not necessarily nonprofits. So I actually don't think that the majority of our students will really be able to capitalize in a significant way on what's available for those who join the Army or do some of the other things that we've talked about.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Dickman, I don't mean to belabor, you know, your situation, but I think we have to understand, you know, back in the 2001, I believe, session when the, help me out, Mr. Berg, but when the Minsky and University Systems took about $160 or $180 million hit each in that area, Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, this 2003 session for okay. Fiscal 4 and 5.
But it was
about a little over $180 million each.
And so at that time we saw significant increases in tuition at our Minsky system and the U. And it would probably coincide when you started your degree. So give us an example of what happened. I mean, credits are now about, are they, am I wrong, doctors, in saying about, are they $1,000 a credit for a professional degree at the U, or am I way off, and that's just for like a master's in business or something? What is the actual per credit charge now for a MD degree?
Representative
Dr. Friedman.
In our situation, it's not a really useful analogy simply because you can't take, it's in our accreditation, you have to start at point A and you end up at point Z. So the tuition is a four-year tuition that covers that period of time.
So maybe I can ask this way then, Dr.
Dickman.
From the time you started during that period when it was escalating to the time you finished, What was the surprise you got in what you thought you were going to pay when you started and what you actually paid when you finished with your degree?
Dr. Dickman?
The nice part about the medical school is that the amount that you pay your first year, that rate is locked in, so there aren't any surprises. So I knew when I signed up it was $27,000 a year, something around that area, just for tuition, without books, without living expenses. But that rate is locked in for 4 years. So in that regard, it's a very smart system, so there isn't a big surprise at the end. You know what you're signing up for.
And would you know some of your fellow peers who came in a year later, were they locked in at 30 or 32 or 35?
That's correct.
What would it have jumped up in a year? 5,000?
I believe inflation rates are somewhere around 5%. It has increased a little bit each year, 5.8, something in that range.
Representative Nornes, if I could.
Dr. Friedman.
On average, it's been about a 5% increase every year.
This?
During good times.
This probably explains, Representative Rukavina, why we don't have any dentists in the legislature. They can't afford it.
Or doctor. Well, because they'd rather pull the other kind of teeth than pull teeth around here.
Right.
Sure, but,
I think we need to move on to our next presenter. So thank you very much for your presentation, Dr. Friedman, Dr. Gary, and Dr.
Thank you very much, Representative Gordon, and the committee. Thank you.
You got it for free. Jeez.
Next, we'll be hearing from the Minnesota Partnership of Biotechnology and Medical Genomics. Should be interesting. They're going to pass the brain. No, they're not going to pass the brain around.
Leave that here. We need an extra.
Thank you.
Welcome to our committee. We're looking forward to your presentation. And who is going to be, you're going to set up first?
Yes, please.
Okay. Go ahead and
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Paller. As you heard earlier, I'm the Executive Vice Dean of the University of Minnesota Medical School and founding co-director of the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics. And my partner on the left, who is trying to get the computer going, is Dr. Eric Wieben, who is the co-director of the partnership and the director of the genomics program at the Mayo Clinic. We appreciate the opportunity to update you to the activities of the partnership, which we sometimes shorthand by calling it the UMayo Partnership. This is a unique partnership that really doesn't, or didn't at the time we started this in 2003, didn't exist in any other state in the country. And we really set the legislature and the university and Mayo Clinic and our private sector partners really set the tone for something which has been tried to be emulated at a few other states in the country. And essentially, we brought together the expertise of the two major healthcare research institutions in Minnesota for the benefit of all Minnesotans. It's a historic partnership, as I alluded to. The idea began in 2003 started with a focus on the biosciences and genomics. We realized that to really make a difference, this isn't something that the university or the Mayo Clinic could do individually, and that the two of us working together were very powerful and more than the sum of the individual parts. Again, with the support of the state and private sector, we were able to accomplish, as you will see, much more than we had been doing individually. We have a very strong foundation in Minnesota. Before the partnership began, we had invested, combined the two institutions individually, more than $1 billion over a period of 5 or 10 years in these specific areas of the biosciences. And as you heard in the previous testimony from the medical school, there's a 50-plus year experience in the medical device industry, and the Mayo Clinic and the university have synergy with regards to their areas of expertise.
Mr. Chair, you've had the pleasure of hearing from the University of Minnesota in the previous testimony, so I won't belabor this, but this slide.
Identify yourself.
I'm Eric Weaver from the Mayo Clinic.
Okay, thank you.
This slide shows the strengths of Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota in a very significant way as two different but interlocking pieces of a puzzle. And the symbolism here is meant to represent the fact that we're not identical institutions, but we have strengths that fit very nicely together to help us fulfill our joint mission for the state. So on the left, Mayo Clinic, again, has made significant investments in the area of genomic medicine. We have a strong electronic patient record system. I won't go through all these in great detail, but we have a lot of resources that focus largely but not entirely on clinical medicine, and we have a strong research group as well, but that research group doesn't encompass the full range of activities that are available at the University of Minnesota, and you can see some of those on the right, and that includes both very strong basic science departments that are essential for moving biomedical research forward, and things like a Center for Drug Design and the Consortium on Law and Values to handle some of the ethical questions going on as well. So these two pieces of the puzzle come together very nicely to position Minnesota really at the top of a lot of the efforts in this area of medical genomics and biotechnology in terms of our capabilities. The partnership really got going, as Dr. Paller said, with some initial discussions back in 2003. And at that time, believe it or not, there were people in the state of Minnesota who didn't have the absolute certainty that Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota could actually work together productively to do joint research projects on a grand scale. So the initial investment was $2 million from the state, matched by $1 million from Mayo and $1 million from the University of Minnesota to do a pilot to see what could happen. And that initial $4 million was used to fund four initial research projects that were chosen on a highly competitive basis. And the requirement was that each project had to have a principal investigator from the Mayo Clinic working with a principal investigator from the University of Minnesota. So this wasn't, let's take the money and we'll go do our thing and you'll go do yours. The idea was to do something that neither institution could really do alone. And those initial projects were in the area of heart disease, and you've heard from Dr. Gary about the strength of the university in that particular area. They were in the area of neurodegenerative disease, things like Alzheimer's. There was one on diabetes and obesity, and the last one was in the area of cancer. So we funded those four projects, and they moved along very nicely and built on the strength of those initial projects. The state realized that we actually could do things productively and followed on, as you see here on the slide, with additional funding not only for continued operating funds of $15 million in 2005 and again in 2006, but some additional bonding to build some additional space for partnership activities on the Mayo campus. In 2007, there was a longer-term commitment of the state built on our progress to that time and working together productively of $25 million for that biennium. And importantly, at that time, the partnership was put into the state's budget as a continuing funding at the level of $8 million a year, and that happened for the next 2 years. The most recent state investment, to give you an idea of what we did with our appropriation last year, was focused on identifying new brain tumor drug targets, cancer therapies, and targeting cancer genes, so bringing in the idea of medical genomics, the development of new modalities for doing sting, some adult stem cell treatments for cardiac disease, and for developing some new capabilities in diabetes prevention, sort of looking forward to the types of activities that Dr. Paller will tell you about at the end of our presentation. So in total, the partnership has funded 54 research and infrastructure projects. And again, each of these has an investigator from Mayo working with an investigator from the University of Minnesota. The research projects are focused on different problems in medical science. The infrastructure is to help us stay current in the arms race for new technologies to make these highly competitive areas move forward. And then we've also invested money, as you see at the bottom, in 6 new research positions. 4 new investigators have brought their talent to the state to support partnership activities. These are paired recruitments. So in cancer experimental therapeutics, there was somebody hired to the University of Minnesota to support partnership activities, paired with a similar focused investigator at the Mayo Clinic. The same in this area of pharmacogenomics, which focuses on the influence of individual genetic variability on drug responses. So, for example, only half the people who are given the antidepressant Prozac will actually respond to that drug. The idea is to be able to predict that in advance. This is an area that we needed some additional expertise. And importantly, in the middle of this slide, you can see that the partnership has attracted some additional dollars from other groups around the state, and the most significant of those has been a $5 million gift from Medica, which was awarded, and these were, again, projects that were picked on the basis of scientific merit, and Medica chose to fund teams in the areas of heart disease, cancer, and HIV research. We also have an additional paired recruitment underway in the area of functional imaging to try to really bring the technology of medical imaging up to speed within the state at a higher level.
I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the outcomes that we've had from this substantial and very generous investment by the state and our other partners. As a result of the initial work that our researchers have done, they have built upon this by attracting an additional of 80, I think now the number is probably $90 million of NIH funding that wouldn't have been possible without the initial work that was done by the support of the partnership monies. In addition, we've had either at the Mayo Clinic or the university at least $20 million of donations to support the activities of the investigators who were initially funded for work by partnership funds. Based on data from either the National Institutes of Health or the U.S. Department of Commerce, they give two different estimates, that based on the research expenditures that we've had that have resulted from the partnership, this has been responsible for between 2,400 and 5,700 jobs that were either newly created or not eliminated otherwise because we had this funding. We've had to date 6 patent applications. We've had 1 startup company, and there's another one in an advanced stage of development that we hope to be able to announce soon. It's important. So the history of the partnership is we were initially funded through economic development, and we came to higher ed in the last biennium. I think that's when it was. And I think it's important to understand what kind of outcomes are reasonable with what kind of time frame. I've already told you about the additional grant dollars that have been brought to the state and the jobs that those support. But from the time that one does initial research and proof of concept of an idea, obtains NIH funding that supports jobs, till the point where you have licenses or patents, and you can send an idea to a research incubator to start to develop a startup company or license the new ideas to an existing company, is 5 to 10 years. At that point in time, this becomes something that's much less under the influence of our two institutions, but it's very important to the economic climate in the country or in particularly the state of Minnesota. So whether a Minnesota company licenses our technology, as we said, we've got the technology that's being that's licensable because of the patents and the discoveries, whether that startup forms in Minnesota or someplace else, or whether Medtronic or some company in another state decides to build on that, really becomes part of the business and economic environment. But I think, as we've demonstrated, we've had really outstanding outcomes on the part that we directly are responsible for.
And the progress has not just been scientific and hasn't just been in the area of patents and licensing and things. I think one of the areas where the partnership has had a major effect has been in the progress towards growing a better bioscience business ecosystem within the state. So at the core of the partnership is Mayo Clinic, the University of Minnesota, and the state. But we've also built very positive and good working relationships with the Biobusiness Alliance in Minnesota. And this is a group that we need to work with to help find better ways to commercialize the intellectual property coming out of partnership projects within the state of Minnesota. And we've spent some time traveling the state to try to understand how can we do that better, not only in the Twin Cities and in the Rochester area, but in greater Minnesota as well. We also have had some serious discussions about integrating partnership activities with another major player in this area in the state, which is IBM, because much of the technology that we use in this area is very information intensive, and IBM clearly has significant assets and capabilities in that area. And I would also note that we have funded partnership joint projects between Mayo and the Twin Cities campus of the University of Minnesota and the Hormel Institute down in Austin. So this is something that has really worked well to bring together the academic institutions, the business community, to try to really further the goals of Minnesota in this area. And it hasn't stopped there. In terms of relationship building, the partnership is building a global reputation for actual progress in the bioscience arena, that we've had contacts with the Czech Republic. And that particular one is notable because there's currently a grant proposal under consideration to the European Union that's requesting euros to support joint projects between the partnership members here in Minnesota and people in the Czech Republic and their biotech cluster. We've also had significant interactions with India, South Korea, and Sweden. And the Sweden interactions have been something that was initiated in large part by the Biobusiness Alliance, because they had some startup companies that were looking for a home in Minnesota. We had some IP that was looking for some help in trying to break into a European licensing agreement, and we've been pursuing those fairly aggressively.
We, as we look forward to the next decade of the partnership's existence, we thought that in addition to the basal activities that we've been supporting, which is focused on preventions, treatments, or cures of human disease, that we really ought to challenge ourselves to focus on a major area. And we considered the possibilities of a strong focus on either Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, or heart failure. And to pick which one we were going to focus on, not only did we look at our scientific abilities, and part of the reason these three disease areas came to the forefront was because we do have strengths at both institutions, but we also went around the state and really asked people in the community whether they had any preference as to which of these major disease areas that we focused on. Interestingly, it was about equal. If you have someone in your family who has heart disease, that's the one you vote for. If you have someone who has Alzheimer's, that's the one. But everybody was in favor of our working on a major problem. And so we've selected diabetes, and you're going to hear more about this in the next couple of years of our focus from the partnership to ultimately cure diabetes. And to simply review why diabetes, it's the seventh leading cause of death in the country, major contributor to blindness. I happen to be a kidney specialist, and half of my patients come to dialysis or transplant because of diabetes, and I'm ready to retire prematurely if we could cure diabetes. That would be fine with me. We have more than 270,000 Minnesotans who have diabetes. A third of Medicare and Medicaid dollars are focused on diabetes treatment. And in Minnesota alone, that's $3 billion a year of health care expenditures just on diabetes. And as you've heard, the problem of adult-onset diabetes, in particular related to obesity, is growing, and we're up to an incidence of 1 in 3. So our goal is to optimally treat something we can do now and ultimately cure something that will require additional research and translation into the community of both types of diabetes. this is going to be a little different than what we've done before, because it's not just research or education that takes place at our two institutions, but we're building a statewide campaign and network, working with providers throughout the state, working with insurers, working with other foundations, working with other other parts of the state government to really not only do discovery but translation and implementation of best practices in diabetes. It's an opportunity for Minnesota. We really hope that this will be, that Minnesota will be the destination for diabetes care. It obviously will provide jobs, high quality jobs, as we've suggested, based on what happens to the companies, et cetera, that grow up around this. It's also something that's important for the health of Minnesota. So we'd be happy to answer any questions, and we do have a website that we pointed out before that has some of the background information if anybody wants to look it up at any time in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Depke.
Thank you very much. Another great presentation. One question I want to ask you is, I know that the Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota have corroborated to have a special medical school for students. I think that for it started about four years ago, maybe 3 years ago. It started with 54 students, and that now they're growing, and their first class will be graduating next year. Is that under this partnership, or is it under another partnership? And the reason I'm asking, because it's the Minnesota partnership, and it's the Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota.
Dr. Pallard?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Depke, I think you're referring to the Minnesota Future Doctors Program. And there are a lot of things we didn't talk about with the partnership, and this is a good example of, because we started working together so closely, we've been able to do other joint activities between the institutions that were undreamed of before. So I play a major role in the Minnesota Future Doctors Program and my role in the dean's office at the university. That program was to take students from underprivileged environments, often first-generation college, and provide them with preemptive tutoring and support to get them interested in health professions. And as you suggest, we've just gotten to our first class of college graduates who have applied to medical school, and our results, we believe, are spectacular. We select our medical school cross-country medical school classes will be selected in a month or 2 months. So we'll know the actual results. But we know from their testing, their MedCat admission tests, that that's going very well. It's something we've continued at the university. The Mayo Clinic is probably not going to continue that there, but it's something that's very important, and we are supporting that. So indirectly, state money goes to support that, not, you know, not through a direct allocation, but the money we get to the university, it goes to medical school. That's how I've been able to fund some of that. And we've had a major donor that also funded that in the past, but that support probably isn't going to continue.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard wonderful things about that
program.
It's
fantastic.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, and I just want to be clear to some folks who might have heard the presentation by the University of Minnesota in Rochester. That is completely different. So it's not tied to the University of Minnesota Rochester, just to be clear about that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
can I make a comment on that, Mr. Chair? Representative Norton, that program is not tied, but I did neglect to mention when I was talking about other partnerships that the University of Minnesota Rochester has also played a role in projects funded by the Minnesota Partnership. So I mentioned Hormel, Twin Cities campuses. University of Minnesota Rochester also has significant expertise in handling large amounts of data, and we've done things there as well.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Seeing none, again, thank you for being here, and great presentation. We have a couple of bills, I think, on Thursday, correct? So please come back, and we're now adjourned.